Hi, welcome back to the channel. This video is a compilation of the best stories from the world of business and finance that I've posted over the last 7 days. If you haven't had a chance to watch all of my videos, this is the perfect place for you because you'll be able to see everything in one place. And because I split all of my videos into chapters, it's really easy to skip through things that you're maybe not that interested in or you've heard about or seen before. So if you have a look in the description below, you'll see all of the different topics that I've covered in this video, and therefore you can jump around and move to the ones that you're interested in, or alternatively, you could watch the whole video if you like. And if you are liking the content, then please give me a thumbs up at some point during this video. And don't forget to subscribe if you haven't done so already. And as always, please post some comments down below. I'm always really interested to hear what people think and what sort of stories you're interested in me posting more about. So thanks for watching, and hopefully you'll enjoy all of the best bits from the last week. Hi, welcome back to the channel. This video is another update on the situation in Turkey. And we've now got the inflation figures for January. So I'll run you through the details of what the inflation was in January. We'll look at the performance in the month and the year to date. And then I'll give you a detailed breakdown of the consumer prices and also the production prices, because Turkey is reliant upon exports for its economic growth. And the rising cost for producers is as concerning as the rising cost for consumers. So I'll go through that in some detail. We'll also have a look at what's going on with administered prices, which are the things that the Turkish authorities set the prices for, because there's been some big hikes in those prices over the last month or so. We'll have a quick chat about the firing of the head of statistics in Turkey, which was done recently. And I'll finish up with a summary looking at the wider picture in Turkey, and we'll talk about what's likely to happen over the next few months. So before we get into all of that, if I could ask you to give me a thumbs up at some point during this video, if you're enjoying the content, I'd really appreciate that. And please subscribe if you haven't done so already. And don't forget that I always include chapters in my videos. So if there's a section that you're not that interested in, it's really easy to skip forward and move on to the next topic. And if you have time, pop a comment in the boxes below and I'll respond to as many as I can. The inflation figures for January have just been released and they don't make for good reading. We are now running at an annualized rate of 48.7% consumer price inflation in Turkey. Now that compares to 36% that we were at for December, so quite a marked increase in the month. Consumer prices rose 11.1% in the month, and if you annualize that level of growth, then that equates to 133% inflation. So these figures are starting to get really concerning. And although we're aware of high inflation and everybody knows what's going on in Turkey right now, these figures are higher than expectations. So the market had been expecting somewhere in the region of 9.5% to 10% within the month, but we're at 11.1%. So the rate of growth in prices is actually picking up pace. The figures for the producer price index are even more concerning. The annualized rate is now up to 93.5%, and the increase in January itself was 10.45%. And if you annualize the rate of growth in January, that equates to 125% inflation in producer prices. So a really concerning set of statistics. But really, to get into the detail on this, we need to look at the breakdown of how these figures have been put together. So this graph shows the consumer price index for Turkey, and we can see that it's been at a high level consistently, so it's been double-digit growth throughout. However, since November, we have seen a pronounced spike in inflation. So we saw that we were at 36% in December, and now we are close to 50% inflation for consumer prices. So we're not officially at hyperinflation yet, because the definition of hyperinflation is when you're achieving 50% growth in prices per month. But it is very concerning, because even at the level we were at in January 2021, that is an unsustainable amount of inflation. But now we're at 50%, then it really is starting to get to the point where things will break down very quickly. So this bar chart shows the annual rate of price increase for a variety of items that feed into consumer prices. So you can see the red line down towards the bottom is the CPI average. That's the 48.69% we've reported upon. So the first thing to note about this chart is that the price of everything in Turkey is increasing at an extremely rapid rate. So communication, which is the lowest of all of these figures, is still coming in at 10.76% growth over the 12 months. Now that is incredibly high. So when you compare 10.76% to the target rate of growth in most economies, which is at 2%, then we're looking at more than five times the expected increase in prices in most economies. But communication is actually the best performer out of all of these categories. And as you move down the chart, the figures get more and more worrying. So we can see that education costs have increased almost 19%, clothing and footwear 25%, health costs 28%, recreation and culture 34%, alcoholic beverages and tobacco 45%, housing 48%, hotels, cafes and restaurants 50%, furnishings, household equipment 54%, food and non-alcoholic beverages 55%, and transportation almost 69%. So the level of these price increases are eye-watering, but what's really concerning here is when you look from the bottom up on this chart, the things that are increasing most rapidly are the things that most people need. So transportation is absolutely essential for all workers in Turkey, and it has increased by almost 70% in the last 12 months. Food and non-alcoholic beverages are obviously absolutely critical for everybody. If you don't have any food, then you can't exist. And an increase of almost 56% over the last 12 months is making life very hard for all Turkish people. Their cost of living has increased dramatically. And when you couple that with the 48% increase in housing costs, you can see how the spending power is really reduced for the population of Turkey. And that's really what's concerning about this chart, is that these items are essentials. If we were seeing large increases in items that related to discretionary spending, then it wouldn't be quite as concerning because people can cut back and you can stop going out to bars and restaurants and having entertainment and things like that if you need to. But housing, food and transportation are critical to everybody's existence. So it's impossible to cut back on all of those things. And that means that the people of Turkey just can't avoid all of these price increases. This chart shows the change in prices in January. So this is a 1 month movement. And the red line in the middle shows that the consumer price index on average increased by 11.1% in January. And if we look at all of the double digit items on this chart, we start at just above the red line. Food and non-alcoholic beverages increased by almost 11% in 1 month. Transportation went up by 11%. So did health costs. Furnishings and household equipment went up by almost 13%. Housing increased 19%. And alcoholic beverages and tobacco went up almost 22%. So these double-digit increases in prices really highlight the problem that we've got here. When you annualize this rate of growth, i.e. multiply it by 12, then you are into above 100% increases in price on an annual basis. So to put that into perspective, you need to earn double what you're earning today to keep the same standard of living at the end of this year. That's what the Turkish population need to achieve. So that shows why inflation breeds inflation, because it means that you need higher wages to keep with the cost of living. And if you're paid more, then obviously that increases the costs and it becomes a vicious circle. And that's the problem that we've got in Turkey right now, is it's really difficult to pull this back. And particularly because the authorities have now started to implement a strategy whereby they are reducing interest rates rather than increasing them. So the risk with that strategy is as you reduce interest rates, it encourages people to spend more, and that therefore could push prices up even higher. So overall, a very concerning set of numbers, both year to date and particularly in the month of January itself. Some really big price increases in all of the key areas for most of the population. The rate of growth for producer prices is also concerning. The producer price index has been increasing at a high level over the last 2 years, but has really spiked in recent months. So we can see that back in January 2021, the rate of increase was sitting at around about 26%, and that steadily increased through until November, and then we have seen a huge spike. So in December, the rate was almost 80%, and now we are above 93%. And this is clearly very concerning for Turkey and the Turkish economy, because Turkey is dependent upon its exports. So its producer prices obviously feed directly into the price of those exports when they're selling them overseas. So if they've got 90% increase in prices, then they will need to pass that on in terms of their sale prices. And if they're not able to do that, then that will hurt their profits and potentially could lose them a lot of business. So it's very difficult to pass through this level of price increase into an open market. And if we have a look at the breakdown by sector, we can see at the top here that we've got the average rate of 93%. And the two big outliers on this chart are electricity, gas and steam, which have grown at 138% over the last 12 months, and energy, which has grown 142%. Now, that is majorly concerning because you can't avoid those costs. These are not costs that you can cut out of your process and use something as an alternative. This is fundamental. When you're producing things, you obviously need electricity and energy and gas in Turkey. So the figure of 93% was concerning, but the fact that we're at around about 140% growth in energy costs, then that is going to hurt Turkish industry. And the fundamental problem that we have here is that Turkey does not have enough natural resources to be able to produce its own energy. So it's having to buy in gas and other products from overseas. The market has gone up dramatically for the whole world in terms of energy costs, but coupled with the fact that Turkish lira has devalued significantly, it's really starting to hit home in terms of these increases in prices for all the producers in Turkey. We have a look at the monthly change in January. Again, at the top, the red line is the average rate of 10.45%, which is extremely high. And most of the categories here are at a similar level. So manufacturing is at 10%, electricity is over 10.6%, and energy was 11.9%. Now, the outlier on this chart is mining and quarrying, and the costs increased by 17.36% in January. Now, that is a concern because iron and steel are two of the biggest exports for Turkey, and iron and steel are commodities. So if Turkish prices increase dramatically, then they will lose business because the people who are buying those items can source them from other countries around the world. So this is a concern for Turkey. They need to manage their costs. They need to stay cost effective in the international markets to make sure that they carry on delivering the level of exports. President Erdogan has stated that the economy will be saved by its exports. He's expecting exports to increase hugely this year. But if they have a huge increase in prices like this, then they will become uncompetitive at some point, and that will hurt them and they will lose exports, and that will make the situation even worse. So overall, a very worrying set of statistics that we're seeing here. Year to date, very, very worrying, over 90% increase in prices. But when you look at what's happening in the month, if we annualise 10.45%, then obviously that's more than 120% inflation, and that is not sustainable. Turkey will not be competitive in the international markets if it has 120% inflation in 2022. This chart shows the annual rate of growth by sector in Turkey. You can see the red line towards the bottom of the graph of 93% for the average increase in producer prices. So let's have a look at the sectors that are sitting below that line. So we've got wood and coal, around about 100% increase over the last year. Textiles and chemicals at a similar sort of level. And then we've got quite a sharp increase as we move into basic metals, electricity, gas, steam and air conditioning. We're hitting 136, 138%. Oil and gas, 163%. And coke and refined petroleum products, 181%. And the problem with the bottom of this chart is that a lot of these products are imported to Turkey. These are things that Turkey are using in their production process to produce goods that they are then exporting. So they're essential to the economy of Turkey. They can't avoid any of these costs, and they're the ones that are rising most sharply. And when you look at the movement in January itself, this is a 1 month movement, you can see that the red line is further up the chart. So there are more items and more sectors that have been increasing more than the average. And the ones at the bottom are really concerning. So coal and ignite has gone up 32% in 1 month. Other mining and quarrying products up 24%. And this links into what we've just talked about, that the mining costs have increased quite significantly in Turkey in the month of January. And this is why, because they're having to buy in things and the price has gone up by more than 24% in 1 month. And the other items on this list that are close to 20% of oil and gas, non-metallic mineral products, paper and paper products and beverages, they are all things that Turkey are importing. And as those prices continue rising, it's going to drive up inflation further because this is the producer costs. So producer costs take longer to feed in because once those goods are finished, they will come out with a higher sales value because the producers will need to recoup the costs that they've had to pay. So this is feeding further growth in inflation in Turkey. Turkey operates a system of administered prices where in some sectors the prices are controlled and set by the authorities. And at the start of this year there was a big increase in a lot of prices, and I thought it was worth running through some of those now because these are feeding through into the inflation figures and are driving up the cost of living for a lot of people in Turkey. Electricity prices were increased by 50% for households and 125% for commercial users in January. Linked to that, gas prices were increased 25% for residential users and 50% for commercial users. Gasoline prices were increased around about 5%. However, the price of gasoline is adjusted on a regular basis. So although 5% sounds relatively low compared to some of these other figures, that will be adjusted almost continually. The tolls on highways and bridges were increased by 25%. And the cost of travelling on railways was increased by a minimum of 20%, but some of the prices rose by as much as 36%. Cigarettes and alcohol are heavily taxed in Turkey, and the tax was increased by 47% in January, which increased the price of cigarettes by around 20% and alcohol by around 30%. Food prices were also affected, and wheat and barley prices were increased by around about 24%. And the rest of transport didn't escape these price rises. Taxi and bus fares were increased by about 36%, and the mandatory vehicle insurance cost that everybody has to pay was increased by 20% for all cars. So there are a lot of really sharp increases in things that people are spending money on a daily basis. These are essential items that can't be avoided. Now, on the positive side, the minimum wage was also increased by 50% in December. However, that's part of the problem. If you increase all of the prices for everything that people have to spend money on, and then you also increase minimum wage, then that is driving inflation. That is going to encourage people to spend more because the prices are going up, and therefore the actual value of all the transactions start rising, and it will become self-fulfilling. A vicious circle that prices go up and you need to pay people more, and it never ends. So these changes have now started to be reflected in the January figures, and we can see that a lot of prices went up double digit in January, and that's likely to continue for the next few months. So the statistics coming out of Turkey are concerning. And President Erdogan didn't like the statistics from December when we saw a 36% growth in inflation. And he recently sacked the head of statistics in Turkey, blaming him for publishing data that he felt overstated Turkey's economic malaise. And he was quoted as saying, "Never mind who is the chairman, can you imagine that hundreds of my colleagues could stomach or remain quiet about publishing an inflation rate very different to what they had established?" And Timothy Ash of Blue Bay Asset Management commented on this sacking, saying this will just increase concern about the reliability of the data in addition to major concerns about economic policy settings. So not good news for the head of statistics, and I would imagine that the guy who's taken on his job is now even more concerned because he's just published data that shows we're at a 20-year high. It's even worse than it was for December. So if he is going to be held responsible for the new statistics, then I don't imagine he's going to be in his job very long either. So what's the summary and conclusion today? Well, inflation has been a concern in Turkey for quite a long time. We've been looking at these figures going up, particularly since the central bank started to reduce interest rates. That has really fueled inflation. And as interest rates have gone down, we've seen inflation going even higher. And at 36% in December, it was really concerning. Now we are at close to 50%. And the numbers in January itself are really, really big concerns. Because when you annualize what's happening over the last 30 days, it's eye-watering. We're at more than 100% inflation, and no economy can cope with that. We're not at hyperinflation yet, not technically, but this is an unsustainable rate. And anecdotally, there's a lot of evidence that prices are actually rising faster than the official rates. So this is completely unsustainable. And one of the major problems that Turkey has is that it's a net importer. It has to import energy. So it's importing gas and other forms of energy, and the price of all of that has gone up massively over the last few months. So Turkey is now at the point where it's struggling to be able to afford to buy in all of that, and it also has to buy in goods that it then processes and produces before it can export the finished articles. And as the prices keep going up, as we've seen in the producer price index, that's going to increase the price for Turkey to sell at, and that's going to make them potentially uncompetitive in the international market. When you couple all of this with the falling value of lira, it's starting to look like a recipe for disaster. It's very difficult to see how Turkey is going to find its way out of this problem. Prices are out of control, wages are starting to increase rapidly to try to keep up with the movement in prices, the economy is starting to suffer, and we're now at a point where the Turkish authorities are running out of foreign currency. So there's a lot of things that are starting to really go wrong for Turkey, and it will be really interesting to see what happens over the next 6 to 8 weeks. So the pandemic has been very difficult for a lot of businesses, but it's been the best time ever for a company called Peloton. And if you're not familiar, Peloton is a business that is based upon home exercise. So the company sells bikes and treadmills, and then they ask all of the people who buy those bikes and treadmills to subscribe to their online service for online classes. So you can sit at home with your Peloton bike and join live classes with people all around the world. So the benefit of that is obviously you don't have to pull on all the Lycra, get all of the gear and go out and look like an idiot on the roads. You can just do it in the comfort of your own home. Peloton was started back in 2011 by a guy called John Foley, who had the bright idea of using technology to enable people at home to join in live spin classes. The popularity of Peloton grew, and in September 2019, the company listed in New York at a valuation of $8 billion. The IPO was priced at $29 per share, and the company raised about $1.1 billion of new money. And on the first day of trading, the shares fell 11%, which wiped off almost $1 billion of its value. The share price bumbled along, and by mid-March 2020, it was down to less than $20. However, that was the time when the world suddenly realised that COVID was a pandemic and everybody started going into lockdown. And lockdowns were the best thing that could ever happen to a business like Peloton. People were trapped at home. They were desperate to do things. They couldn't go outside. In some countries, you weren't allowed to go out and do any exercise. So doing exercise at home with other people online was the dream ticket. All of a sudden, everybody wanted Peloton bikes. Everybody wanted to join the classes. And the membership numbers started to skyrocket. And so did the share price. Between March and December 2020, the share price increased from $19 to $162. So if you'd have been sitting on shares at the start of that period, you'd have been sitting on a profit of more than 8.5 times by Christmas 2020. However, all good things come to an end, and as we've started to move away from the pandemic and lockdowns have become less frequent and less severe, people have started returning to normal existence. So they've stopped using Peloton as much, and the memberships have started to fall, and so have the revenues, and so has the share price. At the peak of the market, Peloton was valued at around about $44 billion. However, the share price is now back below the original IPO price, and the market cap is now sitting back at around $8 billion. So it's fair to say that it's been a roller coaster ride for shareholders in Peloton. And they've now got a large activist shareholder called Blackwells, who's been calling for John Foley to be removed as the chief executive and for the company to be sold. And news has just come through that Amazon are now looking at Peloton with a view to acquiring it. And there are also rumours that Nike is also interested in making a bid. So it looks like there's a potential bidding war in the offing for Peloton, which will be good news for the share price and the existing shareholders. And while we're on the topic of Peloton, I thought I'd mention a couple of interesting stories where fantasy and reality merge and have a real-life impact. On the 9th of December 2021, a new TV show called And Just Like That, which was a reboot of the Sex and the City franchise, launched its first episode. And in the first episode, one of the most popular characters, Mr. Big, had a heart attack and died on a Peloton bike whilst partaking in an online class. Now, the following day, the share price of Peloton fell 11% as a direct result of this TV show. And it led to an extraordinary statement to be made by the company. Dr. Suzanne Steinbaum, who's a preventative cardiologist and a member of Peloton's Health and Wellness Advisory Council, made a statement that said, "I'm sure Sex and the City fans like me are saddened by the news that Mr. Big dies of a heart attack. Mr. Big lived what many would call an extravagant lifestyle, including cocktails, cigars, and big steaks, and was at serious risk as he had a previous cardiac event in season 6. These lifestyle choices, and perhaps even his family history, which often is a significant factor, were the likely cause of his death. Riding his Peloton bike may have even helped delay his cardiac event." She went on to say that more than 80% of all cardiac-related deaths are preventable through lifestyle, diet and exercise modifications. And while 25% of heart attacks each year are in patients who've already had one, like Mr. Big, even then, they're very, very treatable. The lesson here is know your numbers. It's always important to talk to your doctor, get tested and have a healthy prevention strategy. The good news is, Peloton helps you track heart rate while you ride, so you can do it safely. Now that's quite an extraordinary statement about a fictional character. She's referring to the fictional character's family history. Well, he doesn't even have one. He doesn't even exist. But what is really interesting about all of this is that TV can have a massive impact on a real life business. So what is a fictional story? Mr. Big is just a character in a TV show. Because he's seen to be dying as part of his online exercise on a Peloton bike, then people start to feel that that could be a reality, and therefore the share price of the company fell by 10%. And in January 2022, another TV show called Billions also showed one of its main characters having a heart attack on a Peloton bike. And whilst the company may protest and tell everybody that actually Peloton bikes are good for you if you're going to have a heart attack, I think the problem they have is that once a stigma gets associated with a brand and people see things on the TV that they believe, then it's really hard to shift that. But I thought I'd mention the Sex and the City story because it put a smile on my face and I thought it might amuse you too. This week, we've seen the Bank of England increase interest rates for the second time in 3 months. And the official rate of interest has now increased to 0.5%. So 3 months ago, the rate was 0.1%. We saw an increase to 0.25% in December, and now it's been increased to 0.5%. And this will be an ongoing story. We are going to see more interest rate increases all across the world throughout 2022. So the UK and New Zealand have been the first two countries to start hiking rates. In New Zealand, they're now up to 0.75%. We've seen two 25 basis point increases over the last few months, and it's likely to continue. And the reason that we're seeing interest rate increases is all down to inflation. So as you'll know, if you follow the channel, we've got high levels of inflation all across the world. So the current rate of inflation in the UK is 5.4% compared with the target rate of 2%. In the US, we are now at 7% inflation, and that also compares to a target rate of 2%. So everywhere around the world, the inflation levels are way too high, and the traditional way of combating this is to increase interest rates. And the reason for that is because it increases the cost of borrowing for both private individuals and companies, and therefore they have less disposable income. And the logic is that when you've got less disposable income, you will spend less, and therefore there'll be less demand. And as demand falls, then prices should start slowing down. But it's going to take time to feed through. And because the rates of interest are so low at the moment, even if you have a doubling of the interest rate, it doesn't have that much of an absolute impact. So in the UK, the rate has just doubled from 0.25 to 0.5. But 0.5 is still a very low rate when you look at the long-term average. So in the UK, the long-term average is sitting at around about 5%. So 0.5 is 10 times lower than the long-term average. And that's the same situation in the US and Canada and Australia. So we will see more interest rate rises. So it's likely that interest rates will be a lot higher by the end of 2022. We're expecting the rate to be somewhere in the region of 1.5% to 2% in the US and the UK. The big question is how quickly will these rises come through? We're expecting the Fed to increase rates in March in the US, and we don't know exactly how big that rise will be. It's forecast to be 0.25, but it could be a 0.5% hike. And that's why the markets are very jittery at the moment, because everybody's unsure as to how rapidly this program will be introduced and how quickly it will have an impact on the economy. So the microchip shortage is still around and is still causing a problem for the automotive industry. And Ford has just announced that it's either ceasing production or slowing down production in 8 of its factories in the US, Mexico and Canada. Now, taking a step back for a second, the reason that this microchip shortage started was that during the pandemic, a lot of the producers slowed down or shut, and they've taken quite a long time to get back towards full capacity. So we're still seeing problems all across the world, and this is having a big impact in a lot of different areas. We heard Apple recently announce that it was expecting to see reduced revenues because it had a shortage of microchips, but the automotive sector has been hit hardest, because cars these days are highly dependent upon electronics and microchips. So Ford has announced that the microchip shortage will lead to a reduction in volumes in the first quarter of 2022. And they've now stated that from the 7th of February, production at its factories in Michigan, Chicago and Mexico will be suspended. They will be stopping the production of the F1 electric pickup in Kansas City and only running one shift for its transit vans. And it will also only run a single shift and reduced capacity in Dearborn, Kentucky and Louisville. And all overtime in Oakville, Canada will be ceased. So this is just a reminder that we haven't really got away from the full impact of the pandemic yet. It's still causing a problem, not just from all of the lockdowns and the spikes in cases that we're seeing popping up, but just in terms of capacity in a lot of industries. We haven't got back to the position that we were in 2019 before the pandemic started in a lot of different sectors. Meta is the new name for Facebook. Mark Zuckerberg is obsessed with the metaverse, and he sees that as being the future of all business, and particularly Facebook. So he made the bold move recently of changing the name of Facebook to Meta. Nobody really likes the new name. Meta's a bit too short. Nobody really can remember that it's associated with Facebook. And since he's made the change, there's been some bad news for Facebook. And this week, we saw some seriously bad news announced by the company, which led to the biggest single fall in a share price in the history of the stock market. Meta's share price fell 26%, which wiped out over $200 billion of value from the market cap of the business. And because Mark Zuckerberg still owns around 12% of Meta, his net worth fell by over $29 billion in one day. But don't worry, he's still worth around about $85 billion, so he's still going to be okay. And the main reason for the big fall in Meta's share price was that they announced that the number of daily active users, which is a key metric for Facebook, fell for the first time ever. So up until now, Facebook has been growing exponentially. It's been seeing more and more users join its network, but it suddenly started to see people leaving Facebook. And one of the reasons for that is that Facebook is not really very popular with the younger generation. TikTok and Snapchat and a lot of other different apps are way more popular with the youth, and Facebook has got an aging population. So it's been a pretty bad week for Mark Zuckerberg, but he still doesn't hold the record for the individual who lost the most net worth in one day. That accolade goes to Elon Musk, who saw his net worth reduce by $35 billion back in November when he made a tweet to all of the outside world asking if he should sell 10% of his shareholding. So that just goes to show you need to be careful who you're messaging and what messages you're sending. It's been a great week for Amazon, who released some blockbuster financials, and they had the accolade of being the stock that has increased the most in a single day in the stock market history. The shares increased by 13.5% and added $190 billion to the market cap of the company. And Jeff Bezos still owns around about 10% of Amazon, so his personal net worth went up by around about $19 billion. So quite contrasting fortune to what happened to Mark Zuckerberg this week. So in the results themselves, Amazon announced that its profits had increased by $14.3 billion. And of that figure, $11.8 billion related to the increase in the share value of its investment in Rivian. Now, if you follow the channel, you'll know that Rivian is an electric pickup maker, and Amazon was one of the early stage investors alongside Ford. And Amazon has actually signed a deal with Rivian to buy 100,000 electric delivery trucks. Rivian listed in New York in November, and its IPO was initially a major success. And at one point, the company was valued at over $100 billion. Rivian now has a market cap of around about $55 billion, and Amazon owns around about 5% of Rivian. Now, alongside all of this good news from Amazon and all the increase in wealth, they also announced that they were increasing the cost of Amazon Prime membership by 17% in the USA. So it'll be interesting to see how that price rise is received by the customers. But from Amazon's point of view, it's been a great week. The market cap is now up to around $1.6 trillion, which puts it close to the $1.9 trillion valuation for Google, or Alphabet, as it's called on the stock market. But it's still some way behind the $2.3 trillion valuation for Microsoft and the $2.8 trillion valuation for Apple. Apple has just announced that it's launching a new low-cost 5G iPhone based around its SE model on March the 8th. And this is the first new low-cost version that it's produced for more than 2 years. Alongside that, it's also launching an updated version of the iPad. So this update comes hot on the heels of the recent results that we saw from Apple, which were really strong, really positive, and caused the share price to rise quite significantly. Hi, welcome back to the channel. This video is an update on the Evergrande situation. If you've been following my recent posts, you'll know that there has been some exciting activity recently. So we've been waiting for a long period of time for something to happen. We've been waiting for a default to officially happen, and then we've been waiting for Evergrande or the bondholders to do something about it. And just recently, we saw the bondholders starting to prepare to take some real action. Then we saw Evergrande come out and actually have a conference call with the bondholders, which was a bit of a miracle. And then we saw the US hedge fund Oaktree take some decisive action by seizing some of the assets of Evergrande. So this is the first time that this has happened in mainland China and was a real step forward in the process. And I've now got an update on that situation. Evergrande have responded, and it's really interesting to see what's happening. So in this video, I'll give you a quick recap of where we are, what the situation is with regards to the bondholders, the assets, and Evergrande and the risk management committee. We'll have a look at the receivership action that Oaktree have taken, and I'll go through in a bit more detail what a receivership is and how that normally works in the Western world, slightly different in terms of China. We'll then look at what Evergrande's response is now to the receivership and what the implications of this are for both the Evergrande situation and also for all of the other property developers in China and any other businesses in China that have overseas debt. So before we get into all of that, if I could ask you to give me a thumbs up at some point during this video if you're enjoying the content, and please subscribe if you haven't done so already. And remember, I include chapters in my videos, so it's really easy to skip forward to the next section if there's a topic that you're not that interested in. So the situation with Evergrande is now starting to heat up. The battle lines have been drawn between the bondholders and the company, and we're now starting to see some activity. And before I get into all of the detail on what's going on right now, I just wanted to have a quick recap on where we are, because I'm very close to the detail. So it's easy for me to just tell you about the latest development that's happened within the last few days. But I know a lot of people don't have the full view as to where we are and how we got here. And I'm asked quite frequently by viewers to just give a summary as to what's going on and just put everything back into perspective. So in terms of the big picture, Evergrande is the most indebted property developer in the world. It has over $300 billion of debt, and included in that debt is $19 billion of overseas bonds. So these are bonds that have been issued in the international markets and are being held by overseas financial institutions. So a lot of the money is being held by pension funds and big investors like BlackRock. So there is a chance that anybody watching this video might actually have some skin in the game here, because your pension or some of the funds that you have invested could have found their way into this particular company. So it's relevant from that perspective, but it's also relevant because this is material in global economic terms. $300 billion of debt is a big number, but the whole sector in China has massive exposure. There is an estimate of $55 trillion of debt in China right now, and a big chunk of that comes from the property developers. And if that market suddenly goes down and all of these companies fail to repay all of this debt, then that could potentially cause global contagion and could cause another global financial crisis. So that's why we've been covering Evergrande and all the other developers in some detail, because there's a real risk here that this could have a ripple effect and affect every single market around the world. So everything was going well for Evergrande for the last few years, and then the government suddenly decided to change their perspective with regards to property developers. So they brought in a new policy called the Three Red Lines, which was three tests to make sure that companies weren't taking on too much debt. And as soon as they brought those tests in 2020, Evergrande failed all three of them, and they suddenly became under pressure. So they could no longer access the amount of debt that they had historically, and therefore they couldn't continue with their builds because they needed the debt to pay for all of the costs, and that put them in a real difficult situation. So for the whole of 2021, the microscope was on Evergrande, and we were waiting for something to happen with the debt. And in the autumn, we started to see the pressure showing through. So in September, they missed a couple of bond payments and they went to the wire. They had the 30-day grace period. And on the 30th day, the chairman of the company made the payments himself from his own personal bank accounts. And so everybody then became very concerned. And in November, they had another bond coupon that they missed. That had a 30-day grace period. And when that expired in December, the payment wasn't made and the company was officially defaulting. So the rating agencies woke up and they suddenly put Evergrande into default and everybody waited for something to happen. And what happened was that the government of China sent some of their people into Evergrande and established what's called the Risk Management Committee. And the Risk Management Committee is now running the company and it is owned by the government. So the government is now running Evergrande and essentially it's been nationalized. There hasn't been an official statement and the government haven't put any money into the company, but they are now telling the company what to do and making all of the decisions with regards to the assets and what happens in the discussions with the bondholders. So whilst all this was happening, the bondholders were busy making lots of noise and appointing an investment bank called Moelis and a law firm called Kirkland & Ellis, and they were trying to get the company to come to the table to discuss some form of restructuring, and Evergrande just kept ignoring them. So the bondholders then upped the ante and they appointed another law firm called Harneys, who is a specialist in bankruptcy and liquidations, and the bondholders threatened to take some action. In response to that, Evergrande held a conference call at which they asked all of the bondholders to calm down and to wait for 6 months for Evergrande to do something. So that really wasn't a great response to the situation. And we then reported last week that a US hedge fund called Oaktree had some security in their deals and that they had taken action and seized a plot of land in Hong Kong and also sent in a team to take over an ongoing development in mainland China. So that's brought everybody right up to date in terms of where we are. And this video is looking at that Oaktree deal and what Evergrande's response has been. Because as you would expect in China, it isn't the normal response. It's not what you would expect in the Western world. Evergrande have taken quite a different perspective. And that's really what we want to focus in on today. Oaktree is a large US hedge fund that focuses predominantly on distressed debt. So their specialism is coming into deals where the company has got some form of problem, where their debt is trading below par. So it's trading in the secondary market for less than 100 cents in the dollar. And their specialism is really trying to create value from buying into these problem situations and coming out with a positive outcome for themselves and their investors. So when Oaktree got involved with Evergrande, they knew that Evergrande was in a distressed situation. And so they came in with their eyes open and they wanted security in their deals. So this is a big difference to the bondholders. The international bonds that I just mentioned are all unsecured. The people who put money into those bonds don't have any form of recourse against the company if something goes wrong. Oaktree took a position whereby they had security against all of the money that they advanced. So they're in a similar situation to a traditional bank here. And they struck two deals with Evergrande. One was a $400 million loan in China to an established development that Evergrande had been working on for over 10 years named Venice. And the other loan was a $520 million facility in respect of a plot of land in Hong Kong that was named Project Castle. And the reason it was named Project Castle was that when Evergrande bought it, the intention was that the founder wanted to create one of the biggest mansions in the world. He was going to create a really impressive structure that was similar to the Palace of Versailles that was created by Louis XIV of France. Now, the castle was never constructed, so it's just a piece of land that is owned in Hong Kong. And we don't know the details of why Oaktree gave the money to Evergrande, but it may well have been to finance some form of development on that land, to put some apartments on there or some other buildings to try to get the value back out of this investment. And at the time Oaktree made the loan, it was reported that the loan to value was around about 65%. So the value of the land that they have security over was estimated to be around about $800 million in January 2021 when the deal was done. So as I reported in my recent video, Oaktree have actually taken some decisive action and they sent in a receiver to seize that plot of land in Hong Kong with a view to selling it and then paying off their loan with the proceeds of the sale. In addition to that, I also reported that Oaktree have also sent in a team into mainland China on the Venice project, and they are now running the development. So they are managing the build, and they're employing all of the people, and reportedly they will be paying for the costs of that with a view to realising the value. Once everything is completed, they'll be able to sell those apartments and receive in all of the funds. So that was the situation as I reported just recently, but things have now changed. So before I move on to talking about Evergrande's response to the Oaktree situation, I wanted to talk about the concept of receivership. I know a lot of viewers who watch this channel are not financial experts. You're following what's going on with a lot of interest, and you want to learn about what's going on in the world of business and finance. And so I always try to take a step back and explain some of the jargon and the terminology, and to go through what the legal issues are and why people do things. So receivership is a concept that's broadly used in most economies around the world, and it's a situation that covers a period when a company is in financial difficulty and is unable to repay all of its debts. And if you're a lender to that company and you have security, then you have the option of taking control of that security. Now, most banks and financial institutions don't want to send in their own staff. They don't personally want to turn up and say, we now own this building or this land. So there's a whole industry that sits in between lenders and companies that's run predominantly by accountants, and it covers insolvency and bankruptcy. And receivers are individuals who are authorized to operate on behalf of the lender, so the banks. They go in and they are the ones who take control of those assets. So they literally will turn up at the door of a building or a company and say, I'm a receiver and I've been appointed to now run this company or to take control of this asset. So they're like a very professional debt collector. They turn up, they take control of the asset, and then they try to realize the value in it. Now, this can take weeks or months, or sometimes even years to complete if it's a very complex situation. So the receiver goes in, they do all of the legal requirements in terms of advising everybody that they are now in control, and essentially the receiver will then run that asset or run the business if it's a business that is continuing to trade. So if the Evergrande situation was in the US or Europe, what would have happened is that a receiver would have turned up to the land in Hong Kong. They would have secured that land, so they may have put some hoardings around it or some physical security, and they would have notified everybody that they now owned that land and that they were the person to speak to if somebody wanted to buy it. And the receiver would then go and market that land. So they would put postings onto various portals and in various publications, notifying everybody that there was going to be an auction or a sale date, and they would advertise an initial discussion price. So the whole sale process would be initiated by the receiver, managed by the receiver. Once the deal goes through, the receiver would receive the money, and then they would pay back the lender, and any surplus would go back to the company. Because in law, a lender is only allowed to take as much as it's owed. So that can be the initial amount of debt plus some interest and any fees or penalties that are associated with that loan, but they can't keep the full value of the asset. They would have to give any equity over and above what they're owed back to the company, and then the company can use that to pay back its investors. So that's a quick and very basic overview of receivership. That's what would happen outside of China. Inside of China, it's a slightly different situation. So I recently reported that Oaktree had appointed a receiver over the land in Hong Kong, and there hadn't been any response from Evergrande. They hadn't acknowledged this receivership, nor had they taken any aggressive action. So everybody assumed that Evergrande was happy to just let Oaktree take the asset and was just focusing in on all of the other issues that it had at hand. However, we've now heard some news that that isn't the situation. Evergrande isn't prepared to roll over and let Oaktree take this asset away from him. And in fact, they appear to have completely ignored Oaktree's receivership. So Evergrande are carrying on with the sale process themselves, and they are reportedly looking at paying back the Oaktree loan of $520 million and then using any surplus assets to try to put together a restructuring proposal for the overseas bondholders. Now, none of this is official. We haven't seen any formal press release from Evergrande. This is all from unofficial sources, but usually these unofficial sources are quite reliable. So this is a really interesting situation because Evergrande is being run by the Risk Management Committee, and the Risk Management Committee is essentially the Chinese government. So Evergrande is being run by the Chinese government. So we've got a head-to-head between the Chinese government and a US hedge fund right now. And initially it looked like the US hedge fund had stolen a march and they'd gone in and taken the asset and it was job done, game over. But what's happening in reality is that the Chinese authorities are completely ignoring Oaktree and their receivership claims. They're just carrying on as if nothing has happened. So they're going to process the sale of this land, and whether they pay back Oaktree remains to be seen. That is the big question. Now, what we've got here is a situation where the most likely buyer of this land is one of the state-owned enterprises. So basically, one of the government-backed property developers. So the government is paying for this land. So they're sitting as the seller in Evergrande and as the buyer in the state-owned enterprise. Now, that usually doesn't make for a good sales price, because if you're selling it to yourself, you want the price to be as low as possible, especially if any surplus proceeds are going either to Oaktree or to the international bondholders. So the money will be leaving China. So I don't think that the Chinese authorities will want to pay a high price for this land. It was reported to have a valuation of 800 million back in January 21. They know that the debt is 520 million right now. And so it'll be interesting to see whether the trade goes through above 520 million, whether it goes through at exactly 520 million, which would repay the Oaktree debt, or even if it goes through for less than 520 million. There is a chance that this deal could go through at 300 or 400 million because they're the only buyers. And when you're in a buyer's market, the prices do tend to go down significantly. So what issues does this situation throw up? Well, there's quite a few things to look at here. Firstly, the concept of receivership. As I just mentioned, it's an established international protocol. Everybody respects the concept that if a lender has security, then they have the right to do things with that asset, and the company loses control of that asset as soon as a receiver steps in and takes over. That isn't being respected in China. What we're seeing here is the Chinese authorities completely disregarding the concept of receivership. They are not letting Oaktree take control of this land. They're not letting the receiver control the sale process. They're just carrying on as they were. They're just looking at this as still being owned completely by Evergrande. So this situation has big repercussions for all lenders in China. Normally, you would expect that if you're doing a secure deal, if you've got security over some assets, then in the event of problems, you'll be able to affect your security, to realise the value in those assets and to repay your debt. What we're seeing here is that that is not the situation in China. You cannot assume that you'll be able to take over those assets, because if the Chinese authorities want to get involved, they will just disregard your security, they'll disregard your receivership, and you won't actually be able to do anything. So that changes your position from a secured lender to an unsecured lender. And normally an unsecured lender gets paid more, so the interest rates are higher, but also it changes the risk profile. So most lenders are comfortable lending on a secured basis, but uncomfortable lending unsecured because it's much higher risk. So this situation basically is saying that anybody who feels like they're a secured lender in China potentially isn't. Potentially, you might be unsecured. And that really increases the risk profile for all of those loans. So a really big implication for anybody doing business in China. The second factor here is the lack of communication. So we're not seeing any direct communication between Oaktree and Evergrande. There are no meetings, there's no restructuring discussions. It's literally Oaktree are doing something, they're taking some action, and Evergrande are just ignoring it. So the message that that sends to the market is that the Chinese authorities don't want outside influence in their country. They don't want to start meeting with overseas institutions and lenders. They don't want to be sitting around the table talking about what the best course of action is. They just want to carry on as if nothing's happened. So I think that sends a really negative message to anybody that wants to do business in China. You're running the risk of, if the Chinese authorities suddenly decide they no longer want to talk to you, then you'll be cut off And because they decide what the laws are and how everything operates, you're really in a very weak position. So I think this is a wake-up call for anybody who's doing business in China to realize that the rules of the game can be very different, especially if things don't go to plan. And the final point I wanted to make here is that even though we've got a lot of independent commercial businesses in China, there is always the risk that the authorities will get involved and that they will start dictating what happens. So you don't get a normal market. It isn't a true market position. And the price of the land for this Project Castle deal will be set by the buyer in this arrangement. And the buyer is going to be the Chinese government, because the government owns the state-owned enterprises, and therefore it will decide what price it wants to pay, because it also controls Evergrande. So it's on both sides of this equation. And that's really bad news for anybody involved. So Oaktree are unlikely to get a really good outcome here unless the Chinese authorities decide that they want to do them a favour. So again, a really negative message to the outside world that in the event of something going wrong, we can close in on this deal and we can decide what the price is for any of these assets. So not an open market sale, not an open market price. Literally, a decision is made from the authorities and that is the price. So what's the summary and conclusion today? Well, the situation with Evergrande is starting to get really interesting. Initially, it looked like we were starting to see international protocols being accepted in China and receivers going in and taking control of assets, and we would start to see a normal restructuring process emerge from the slightly messy situation we had historically. What we're now seeing is that that really isn't happening. The Chinese authorities are dictating what will happen, and they will ultimately decide what happens with Evergrande. We talked about it before, but all of the valuable assets of Evergrande will end up owned by the state-owned enterprises. The government will take back all of the assets that they want, and they will leave behind the debt and the liabilities with Evergrande. It's most likely that Evergrande will be rebadged as an electric vehicle company, and we may well see that trying to list in New York or some other international exchange at some point in the future, because when you look at the valuation of electric vehicle companies, they're off the scale. So I'm sure somebody in China is currently trying to work up a plan to do a listing of Evergrande electric vehicles for $100 billion. But the response that we're seeing from the Chinese authorities with regards to the Oaktree situation and also the situation with the international bondholders shows that there's unlikely to be an open book renegotiation here. We won't see a long drawn out restructuring and lots of to-ing and fro-ing. What we will see is swift action happening. We will probably see a lot of the assets suddenly being transferred over the next 3 to 6 months. And at that point, there may well be a discussion about restructuring, because there will be very little value left in the Evergrande business itself. It will essentially just be a shell vehicle at that point that has $300 billion of debt and very little in the way of assets. Hi, welcome back to the channel. This video is another update on the situation in Turkey. We've just seen the latest trade figures for January. So we've got the level of imports and exports and the resultant trade deficit. And so I wanted to give you the full breakdown of what happened, where we are year to date, and what the likely position is going forward. So President Erdogan recently made a statement that exports were going to be the growth of the Turkish economy, and that was going to lead them out of all of the problems that they're having right now. So in this video, we'll have a look at the details of the figures from January. We'll also have a look at the level of imports and exports provided by the Statistics Office from Turkey. And we'll have a detailed look at the level of currencies required for both imports and exports as provided by the Turkish Office of Statistics. Some really interesting information in there. And finally, I'll wrap up with a summary as to what is going on right now with regards to trade and currency in Turkey and what's likely to happen over the next 3 to 6 months. So before we get into all of that, if I could ask you to give me a thumbs up at some point during this video if you're enjoying the content, and please subscribe if you haven't done so already, and pop a comment down below if you want to let me know what you think of this video, the new mic that I'm using, or any other videos. And don't forget that I include chapters in my videos, so if there's something that you're not that interested in, it's really easy to skip forward. So Turkey has been experiencing a current account deficit each month for a long period of time. And that means that the level of imports have been greater than the level of exports. And therefore, each month they run up a net deficit that they have to fund centrally. Now, President Erdogan's new policy is focused on lower interest rates and increased exports. And it was announced at the start of January that the year-on-year trade deficit had reduced by 7.8% in the year to December 21. However, the trade deficit was still sitting at $45.9 billion. The trading results for January have just been announced, and they show that the trade deficit jumped 240.7% year-on-year to the end of January 22. And the trade deficit in the month itself was $10.44 billion. Exports in the month increased 17.3% to $17.59 billion, but imports increased 55.2% to $28.03 billion. And included in that figure was $9 billion worth of energy imports. Now that compares to $2.6 billion that Turkey imported in January 2021. So a huge increase in the cost of energy imports in the month. Now, Turkey imports energy predominantly from Russia, Azerbaijan, and Iran. And the increase in costs is down to an increase in demand in Turkey and also an increase in global prices for energy. The rise in exports in the month was driven by a 57.8% jump in iron and steel exports, a 2.5% increase in machinery and boiler exports, and a 1.2% increase in automotive exports. This graph shows the level of exports and imports over the last 2 years in Turkey. So the blue line is the amount of imports, and the red line relates to exports. And then the bar chart at the bottom shows you the balance. So you can see the problem that Turkey has. We've talked about this before on the channel. It imports more than it exports. So the blue line is at a higher level than the red line. And that is pretty constant. So when you look back over the last 2 years, these two lines are almost parallel. They move in tandem. And one of the reasons for that is that Turkey has to import raw materials and unfinished goods, which it then produces and manufactures and then exports back out. So it's a low labor cost economy. It encourages industry to invest in Turkey because it's relatively cheap to do things that are labor intensive in Turkey. And 93% of all of the exports relate to manufacturing industries. And part of the problem that Turkey has is that there's not enough added value. If the exported goods were significantly higher value than the imported goods, then we may see these two lines crossing over, that you would import cheap raw materials and then you could export something that was highly valuable. But because these are manufactured items, there is only a relatively thin margin being added. And that's why the two lines are moving in tandem. And that's the cause of the problem in Turkey, that it is constantly importing more than it's exporting. And therefore, there's always a need for more currency. And it's really difficult to get out of this arrangement. And if you look at the bar chart at the bottom, you can see the seasonality. So there are fluctuations over the last 2 years. So there's periods when the net deficit gets wider, and they're the bigger bar charts, and then it starts to narrow back down again. And you can see the seasonality as it moves through each year. And what you can also see on this chart is that things have started to get worse at the end of 2021. So you can see that the blue and the red line is relatively close together. But as we've moved through into November and December 21, there is a widening of the gap. And that's reflected in the bar chart at the bottom. And if you compare it to what happened in 2020, we see that in December 2020, the deficit actually reduced compared to November. So it was 5.1 billion in November and it reduced to 4.5 billion in December 2020. In 2021, we've moved from 5.4 billion in November to 6.8 billion in December. And as I mentioned at the start of this video, we're now at 10.4 billion in January. And if you look back at January 2021, you can see that there was actually a reduction between December and January. It went from 4.5 to 3.1. This time round, we've gone from 6.8 to 10.4. So quite a material difference to what we saw last year. And this is driven partly by what's happened with the Turkish lira. So the lira has devalued significantly over the last few months. It fell 44% in the whole of 2021, but it fell around about 20% in the 3 months at the end of 21 itself. So that's meant that it's cost more to buy all of the imports. The Turkish lira is worth less in the international markets. So for every dollar, you're having to spend more, and therefore that's pushed up the price of the imports. So you can see that in the graph. You can see the sharp increase in the blue line, which reflects the fact that the Turkish lira fell so dramatically. Now, this chart doesn't plot what's happened in January, but if it did, it would show a further increase. It would be very similar to what we've seen on the inflation chart, where there's been a big spike in January. So I wanted to show this chart because I think it's a really good representation of what the problem is in Turkey. They're always having to pay more out for imports than they're receiving back in exports. And that means that they always have this trade deficit. Now, President Erdogan has stated that he wants to remove this by driving up the value of exports. But the problem with that is that they have to import all the goods before they can produce and manufacture and then export them. And as the Turkish lira has fallen in value so much, the cost of importing those goods has increased dramatically. And therefore, it's made Turkey less competitive in the international export markets. So it's difficult to see how this deficit is going to be removed given the current circumstances of the economy. Now, I wanted to dive a bit deeper into the currency issues that Turkey face. And the Turkish Statistical Institute provide data on the amount of foreign trade by US dollars, euros, and Turkish lira. If we have a look at this spreadsheet, it shows the amount of dollars, euros, and lira that the country has been spending on imports and has been receiving for exports. So if we look at the export figure for US dollars, we can see that in 2021, Turkey received $225 billion in exports. If we scroll down and look at the figure for imports, we can see that Turkey paid $271 billion out for imports. So the difference, which I've added to this table, is $46 billion. That's the net deficit. And if we look at the figures per month, we can see that the deficit has been getting larger recently. So in November, it was $5.4 billion, and in December, it was $6.8 billion. If we look at the same figures for euros, we can see that Turkey received 191 billion euros in exports and paid out 230 billion for imports, which is a net difference of 39 billion deficit. And if we look at the monthly figures, it's the same pattern, with November resulting in a 4.7 billion euro deficit, and December the deficit increased to 6 billion. So some really interesting statistics here. And what this highlights is the fact that there are net currency outflows every single month for Turkey. They need to have more currency because they're spending more than they're receiving. And until they get to the point where exports are worth more in value terms than imports, then they'll always have a need for foreign currency because they're doing such huge transactions in dollars and euros every single month. So what's the summary and conclusion today? Well, clearly the trade figures for January have not been good for Turkey. They've run up a large deficit in the month, which has increased 240% compared with January 21. Now, the main factor in the results has been the massive increase in energy costs. Turkey is constantly buying in energy from overseas, and because of the increasing prices and also the fact that Turkish lira has devalued significantly, it's meant that the actual value has increased more than three times compared with January 21. Now, I've discussed this a lot on this channel. Turkey is highly dependent on overseas energy, so it can't really do anything to break out of that cycle. This isn't an import-export issue. This is the fact that they're having to pay higher prices in the international markets to keep their power stations operating and to keep people's homes supplied with gas. But a further concern is that when you strip out the energy costs of $9 billion in the month, there was still a net deficit in January. President Erdogan is focused on exports and wants to export his way out of all of the troubles, but Turkey has two major problems. Firstly, it's not adding enough value to the manufacturing process, so the level of exports is not outpacing the level of imports. But the other main factor here is the Turkish lira value. As we've seen a huge deterioration in the value of the lira, that's meant that foreign currency is costing more, and therefore the value of imports has risen significantly. So we've actually seen quite a widening in the trade deficit gap in January, and that's likely to continue through the whole of 2022. I can't see this position turning itself around because the fundamentals just don't add up to tell me it's going to do that. So it's more likely that we will see the trade deficit continuing to widen as we go through the first 3 to 6 months of 2022. And that's going to put even more pressure on the Turkish economy. They're currently under a lot of pressure to keep the gas supplies coming through. They're having to find foreign currency from wherever they can locate it. So they've asked the people of Turkey to hand over their currency. They've asked the industries of Turkey, the selling citizenship, to bring in more currency. But even with all of those mechanisms in place, they're still running out of currency. So unless they can do something to really drive up exports without continuing to import raw materials, they're not going to be able to find a solution to this problem. So this is a real genuine concern for Turkey and the Turkish economy. SoftBank is the giant Japanese investment bank that focuses in investing in early stage technology companies. SoftBank have had a really bad run of form. It started with WeWork, which they heavily invested into, and have now had to write down the value of that investment by tens of billions. But they've also had disasters with Didi, the Chinese ride-sharing app that I featured on this channel, which listed in New York in 2021 and immediately had all of its apps removed from China, which led to a huge fall in the share price. And they've also incurred huge losses on investments that they've made in businesses such as DoorDash and Alibaba. But one glimmering light on the horizon for SoftBank was their investment in Arm. And Arm is a UK-based microchip producer. And this is one of the biggest players in the whole world. And SoftBank bought Arm in 2016 for $32 billion. Arm is based in Cambridge in the UK and focuses in on the technology around microchips. So it produces its own microchips, but it also licenses out the technology to hundreds of other companies. So it's a really important player in the whole world of microchips. And these chips and the technology are used in everything. So Apple and Samsung and a lot of the smartphone manufacturers use these chips, and it's everything right through to appliances such as toasters that are utilizing this technology. Back in September 2020, so a very long time ago, SoftBank announced that it had agreed a sale of the Arm business to Nvidia, the California-based chip business. The headline price at that time was $40 billion, and the deal was structured $21.5 billion of shares in Nvidia and the rest being cash. As soon as the deal was announced, it was referred to a variety of regulators and market commissioners. And over the last 18 months or so, the deal has come under increasing pressure as there were concerns about controlling the market, reduced amount of innovation, reduced amount of competition, and price increases. Now, as you'll be aware, if you follow the channel, there's been a microchip shortage over the last 6 to 12 months. So this has meant that businesses like Arm have become even more attractive, and the share price of Nvidia actually increased significantly. And at one point, this deal was valued at $80 billion because 50% of the payment was coming in shares from Nvidia. Now, those shares have actually come back down again now, but it shows you how the value of a business like this can increase through a period when it's being investigated by the Monopolies Commission. And it's just been announced that SoftBank have now pulled the sale of the business. It is not going to receive approval. They're being sued through the US courts, and they've decided to walk away from the transaction. So this is another hammer blow for SoftBank. They're really under pressure right now. Their latest fund is underperforming and they're wanting to raise more money and they needed a good exit. They needed to show that they can actually make a profit on some of these deals. So this is really bad timing for SoftBank and it's back to the drawing board for them. There are rumors that they will now look to do an IPO in Europe of Arm, but that will take some time unless they can find a SPAC to reverse into, of course. But the problem SoftBank will have right now is that the markets are very jittery. We've seen the markets going up and down, and there's a lot of concern about rising interest rates having a really negative impact on the markets. So whether or not SoftBank will be able to launch their IPO and whether they'll be able to get a price that they're happy with remains to be seen. So last week we saw the latest figures released by Meta, and they were a disaster. The big concern for everybody is that the number of daily active users has fallen for the first time ever. And there are worries that the younger market is not being attracted to Facebook and that its usage will decline and therefore so will its revenues and its profits. And we've now heard some even more worrying news from Meta. And this news relates to European privacy regulations. The latest annual report to the Securities and Exchange Commission states that European privacy regulations complicates its platform's functionality and ad products. Specifically, the rules prohibit cross-border transfers of user data, so Meta can't process Europeans' information in its US-based servers. Meta went on to state that if a new transatlantic data transfer framework is not adopted and we are unable to continue to rely on SCCs or rely upon other alternative means of data transfers from Europe to the United States, we will be unlikely to offer a number of our most significant products and services, including Facebook and Instagram in Europe. It finished off this filing stating that as a result of these or other factors, our metaverse strategy and investments may not be successful in the foreseeable future or at all, which could adversely affect our business, reputation or financial results. So some quite serious implications for the Facebook and Instagram businesses if this European regulation is upheld and if it does prevent all of this data being processed by US servers, then it means that Facebook and Instagram won't be able to offer a global service. And that is at the heart of the metaverse concept. So Mark Zuckerberg has been focusing a lot of his attention onto the metaverse. He thinks that that's the way the world is moving, that in 5 years' time, we'll all be living in the metaverse. We'll be going to work and having some socializing and doing everything through virtual headsets. And if he can't join everything together, then that means that his metaverse won't be functional. It'll only be focused on individual geographical regions. So there's a clear implication here from Meta that they want these rules and regulations to be changed because they're saying that it's preventing them from being able to operate and be able to run their normal businesses. But the problem he's got here is that regulators don't usually just change their rules and regulations because it fits one particular business. They have rules and regulations in place because they want to protect the consumers, not because they want Facebook or Instagram to make more money. So I think the more obvious outcome here will be that Meta will have to set up some data centers in Europe so that that data is not being transferred back to the US technically, and then they would get around all of these problems. But if they do that, then obviously they'll need to increase their cost base and there'll be some period of time when they have to integrate the two systems. So this all means more cost, more development and probably lower profits for Meta. So more bad news from Meta and potentially some really big bad news. I'm sure they wouldn't want to close down Facebook and Instagram in Europe. It's highly profitable for them. It's a big part of their operation. If they had to, I guess they could also split the company into two and they could have a separately listed European arm and a US arm with completely separate data systems. So there's a lot of ways around this, but just in the short term, this is causing a big problem for Facebook and Instagram, and it's causing a problem for Meta. And the last thing that Mark Zuckerberg needs at the moment is any more problems. A lot of bad news coming his way right now. So if you follow this channel, you'll know that we are big fans of SPACs, Special Purpose Acquisition Companies. And SPACs are set up as a cash shell floated in New York, and then that SPAC merges with another business and becomes the listed entity for that business. So SPACs offer a shortcut way of floating your business, and the problem we've seen with SPACs is that they are highly speculative. When people buy shares in a SPAC, they don't really know what that business is going to become, so it's a complete gamble, and the share price tends to be highly volatile, so they can go up and down really rapidly. And we've seen some really disastrous performance post-merger. So a lot of businesses that have merged have seen a big fall in their share price once investors can see exactly what the business itself is. But the latest SPAC that's in the news is CF Acquisition Corp. 6. So CF Acquisition Corp. is a shell vehicle that is listed in New York, and it has agreed a merger with a company called Rumble. And Rumble is a very, very small scale competitor to YouTube. So it's a video sharing platform that was founded in 2013 in Canada by a guy called Chris Pavlovsky. And for the first few years of its existence, it didn't really grow particularly rapidly, but it started to pick up a bit of pace after Donald Trump left the White House and he became banned from social media. And Rumble decided that it wanted to be the freedom of speech platform, so there was to be no censorship. Everybody could post videos without running the risk of being taken down. And the popularity of Rumble has been increasing, and it announced recently that it has around about 44 million active users every day. Now that compares to over 2 billion active users that YouTube have, so it's a very, very small fish in comparison. So Rumble announced the merger with CF Acquisition Corp. 6 in December, giving it a valuation of $2.1 billion. And as part of that, it's agreed a $100 million PIPE deal, so it's raising some pre-flotation money. And it's aiming to raise $400 million of new money upon the merger. And the reason that this SPAC is in the news is all down to Joe Rogan. Now, Joe Rogan is a guy who runs a podcast on Spotify. He's been in the news everywhere recently, because he's come under a lot of pressure because some of his podcasts have been accused of having racial slurs within them. And also he's accused of having people on his podcast who've been spreading misinformation about COVID. Now, Joe Rogan has apologized about the racial slurs and he's taken down the old podcast that included some of that language. But with regards to the COVID discussions, he said that it's a freedom of speech vehicle and that he's just allowing people to come on and talk about what they believe. Now, this freedom of speech angle obviously appealed to Rumble, and the chief executive of Rumble tweeted Joe Rogan, offering him a job and a guarantee of $100 million if he comes and joins Rumble. Now, this led to a lot of excitement on the stock markets, and the share price of CF Acquisition Corp. 6 rose around about 30% as soon as this tweet came out. Now, Spotify have been pretty quick to close down this rumour, and they've released a statement saying that Joe Rogan is staying with Spotify, and I'm sure all of this is great news for Joe Rogan himself, but it's also been good news for Rumble because it's raised their profile, it's got their SPAC in the press, it's got everybody looking at what Rumble is and thinking about freedom of speech video platforms. So overall, all good news, and it hasn't cost anybody a penny. Apart from Spotify, we're probably going to have to double Joe Rogan's pay now. Another SPAC that's also linked to the Rumble deal is Digital World Acquisition Corp. And if you follow the channel, you'll know that Digital World Acquisition Corp. has announced the merger with Trump Media, which is Donald Trump's social media venture. So if you've been living under a rock and you're not familiar with this story, Donald Trump was banned from all forms of social media following his exit from the White House. So when he was in the White House, Donald Trump was a prolific tweeter. He used to send out regular tweets that were quite surprising for somebody in his position. And when he was banned from social media, all of that opportunity was taken away from him. So to counteract that and to also implement a freedom of speech vehicle, he's now creating his own social media platform. So Trump Social is looking to establish a Twitter competitor. And alongside that, it's also signed up a deal with Rumble to provide video, cloud sharing and streaming services. So it's now got all of the different bases covered from a social media perspective. So when the tweet from the founder of Rumble was sent to Joe Rogan, it initially caused the Digital World Acquisition Corp. price to rise to almost $100. And that's a groundbreaking level for a SPAC. All SPACs list their shares at a base price of $10. So to get up to almost $100 represents a 10 times increase before the merger has even happened. The share price of Digital World Acquisition is the highest performer out of every single SPAC pre-merger. However, unfortunately, the good news didn't last. The newly appointed CEO of Trump Media announced that, unfortunately, the launch date of the 21st of February has now been delayed until the 31st of March. So the share price has now moved back down closer to $80. That still represents more than 8 times the original price for the SPAC and is around double the level of the share price when I posted the original video on the Trump Media SPAC. So the share price is doing well, but unfortunately we're now all going to have to wait just a little bit longer before we start seeing any output from Trump Media. Hi, welcome back to the channel. This video is another update on the situation in Turkey. And in today's video, I want to talk about dollarization. Now, dollarization is the situation you get to when a country starts to use the US dollar alongside its own currency. And that is happening right now in Turkey. And the level of dollarization has started to get to the point where it is a major concern. So in this video, I'll run through exactly what dollarization is. We'll have a look at the latest data from Moody's, which shows the level of dollarization in Turkey right now. And I'll talk about some of the other countries where dollarization is extremely high. I'll have a look into the reasons why a country starts to move to a situation where it wants to use the US dollar rather than its own currency. We'll then move on to talk about what issues this throws up for the country going forward and how it affects the economy. We'll then have a look at some of the specific factors relating to dollars in Turkey. If you follow the channel, you'll know that the Turkish authorities have brought in a variety of schemes to try to gather in as many dollars as they can for the Turkish Central Bank. And then finally, I'll wrap up with a summary as to what the likely situation is going to be over the next 3 to 6 months in Turkey. So before we get into all of that, I'd be really grateful if you could give me a thumbs up at some point during this video if you're enjoying the content. And also if you could subscribe if you haven't done so already. And don't forget that I always include chapters in my videos. So if there's a topic that you're not that interested in, it's really easy to skip over it and move on to the next. So the definition of dollarization is the situation when the US dollar is used in addition to or instead of the domestic currency of another country. Dollarization usually happens when a country's own currency loses its usefulness as a medium of exchange due to hyperinflation or instability. So the main driver for dollarization to occur is inflation. When you have high levels of inflation, the value of the currency in your pocket reduces on a daily basis. You can buy less goods for every single unit of currency. And if the rate of inflation gets to extremely high levels, then people and companies within that country move to the dollar because they want a store of value. They want to maintain the value that they've built up. You don't want to see your personal net worth evaporate because you're a millionaire in a currency that suddenly becomes worthless. So in these situations, there is a rapid movement towards a currency that everybody has confidence in, and globally, that is the US dollar. And dollarization has been around for a very long time, more than 100 years. And we see partial dollarization, where countries adopt the dollar alongside their own currency, and we've even seen full dollarization, where certain nations have abandoned their own currency and moved full-time to the US dollar. So there are a number of small countries that have adopted the dollar exclusively, and the list includes British Virgin Islands, Caribbean Netherlands, Marshall Islands, Federated States of Micronesia, Palau, and Turks and Caicos Islands. But we've also got a long list of countries that are using the US dollar alongside their native currency. Official data on the level of dollarization is hard to come by because it's not something that most countries want to advertise. You don't want to be telling the world that your own currency is on its way out and defunct and that everybody prefers to use dollars. But we've got a chart here from Moody's which shows the level of dollarization at the end of 2020. And Moody's definition of dollarization for this table is the percentage of foreign currency deposits in the domestic banking system. Now, in this table, you can see there are three countries with a level of dollarization above 50%. They are Azerbaijan, Belarus, and Uruguay. And there are specific reasons for all three of them. Azerbaijan is a relatively small country, and its economy is dominated by oil. And when the global oil price collapsed in 2014, it plunged the Azerbaijan economy into crisis. The fall in the value of oil caused the local currency, manat, to crash. And initially, the central bank tried to support it by buying currency in the open market. But eventually, it gave up on that. And the rapid devaluation combined with a loss of confidence led the country to move to a dollarization situation. Belarus was formerly part of USSR, and when it became independent, it created its own currency called the ruble. Now, the ruble was initially linked very closely to the Russian ruble. However, after a series of crises and a redenomination of the currency, the central bank decided to tie the ruble to the US dollar. That didn't solve the problems in Belarus, and eventually they had to undertake a second redenomination at a 10,000-to-1 rate. So a long-standing lack of confidence in the Belarus ruble has led to very high levels of dollarization. The highest ranked country on this table is Uruguay, which is a small South American country with around about 3.5 million population. Uruguay is a neighbour of Argentina, and in 2002, there was a financial crisis in Argentina, which resulted in all bank accounts being frozen. A lot of rich Argentinians held money in Uruguayan banks. And at that point, there was a run on all of those banks as all the Argentinians wanted to remove their US dollar deposits. This had a huge negative impact on Uruguay and caused a financial crisis in the country. And the value of the local currency, the peso, fell dramatically. That crisis, combined with high levels of inflation, led to a loss of confidence in the peso, and all of the population and companies in Uruguay moved to using the US dollar. And now over 60% of all loans made in Uruguay are made in US dollars. So if we have another look at the table, we can see that fourth on this chart is Turkey, which at the end of 2020 had a dollarization level of around about 45%. Now, Moody's have provided an update on this situation, and they are now stating that at the end of 2021, the level of dollarization was 63%, and they're forecasting that that will increase to 65% by the end of 2022. Now, there are two different factors relating to dollarization. There is unofficial dollarization, which is day-to-day usage. So this is actually cash usage, people using the greenback to buy goods and services. And then there is the financial dollarization. And financial dollarization relates to loans. So some banks decide that they don't want to make loans in the local currency, and they would prefer to make loans in US dollars because they know what the long-term value of a dollar is. And if you take a loan in US dollars from a bank, then you need to have US dollars to repay that loan. So that means that you will want to hold onto US dollars as a deposit. So that's one of the reasons why you can see high levels of deposits in all of these different countries, because as the population borrows money in dollars, it needs to retain dollars to be able to repay that. And also, the population has more confidence that dollars have a good long-term value, that they're not going to be halving in value every 6 or 12 months. So what are the reasons for an economy moving to using the US dollar rather than its local currency? Well, there's a variety of factors. The first is confidence. So if you have a currency that is devaluing frequently, then people start to lose confidence in it. So let's take the extreme example of somebody who's just won the lottery. And if you've won $1 million on the lottery, then you know that you are financially safe. You're going to be happy for the rest of your life. However, if the value of that $1 million suddenly deteriorated rapidly and it became worth only $10,000, then you would no longer be financially secure and you'd have to go and find some more money. And that's really the summary of what's happening in a lot of these countries. You may be sitting thinking that you're very wealthy and you may have millions of whatever the local currency is. But if you see a rapid deterioration, then that can wipe out your net worth really quickly. So if we look at what happened in Zimbabwe, in 2008, just prior to the collapse of the Zimbabwe dollar, inflation was recorded at being in the billions. So essentially, the local currency became worthless. And what happened in Zimbabwe at that time was that they abandoned their local currency and moved to using the US dollar. So if that happened to you, you could see your net worth evaporate. So in our example, you could go from being a millionaire to being penniless within a short space of time. And people are worried about that. So when you start seeing very high levels of inflation and the currency devaluing, people want to move their net worth and move their investments out of the local currency and into something that they have confidence in, which is generally the US dollar. So that's what's happening on a local level. But when you look at companies and what's happening in international trade, a lot of business that goes on in countries relates to international trade and either multinationals who have operations in a local country or they're trading with multinational companies. So when you're dealing in the global economy, the generally accepted currency is dollars. So you can have an exchange rate and you can pay in your local currency and you just have to work out how much that equates to in US dollars. But if your local currency is starting to deteriorate in value rapidly, then nobody wants to deal with your local currency because the value of the money that they're receiving is going to be a lot less. So when that happens, all of the companies in a country will move away from the local currency because it's too difficult to manage and too volatile. And they'll then want to start invoicing people in dollars. And they'll also want to be paid in dollars because they're having to buy things in dollars in the international markets. Dollars are a safe way of trading. You know what the value of a dollar is. If you're dealing in local currency, then you run the risk of losing money if that devalues rapidly. So when you've got a situation like you've got in Turkey right now, where we've got high levels of inflation and the currency devaluated rapidly through 2021, then people move away from using that currency because it's too high risk. They don't want to run the risk of making losses because of exchange rates. It's difficult enough as a business making profit, but what you don't want to do is run the risk of all your profits being wiped out because exchange rates moved against you. So companies also want to move away from the local currency to US dollars. And taking that to the next level, if you've got a company that's dealing predominantly in dollars, it's receiving most of its income in dollars, then it will want its financial obligations to also be in dollars. So if you're taking loans from banks, then it makes sense to take that loan in US dollars because you know what your US dollar income is and you know you've got the cash to pay back that loan. So everything starts to move away from the local economy and move into international US dollars. And that's what dollarization is. And that's what's happening in Turkey right now. So looking at the figures that we've just talked about, we were at around 45% dollarization at the end of 2020. At the end of 2021, it's now 65%. So it's now 2/3 of the economy is US dollars. So the Turkish lira is actually in a minority now in terms of the loans that people are taking and the transactions that are being done. And this is predominantly because the Turkish economy depends upon exports. Turkey imports a lot of goods, which it then processes and manufactures and then exports back out. And all of the companies who are involved in that process want to deal in dollars. They're buying items in US dollars and they are being paid in US dollars by their clients. So they want to keep everything in dollars because it's much simpler. If you have dollar denominated accounts, dollar denominated deposits, then you know where you are. You know what your ins and outs are, and you've got the currency to cover it. If you're having to switch those dollars to Turkish lira and then switch them back again, then you're running the risk of the exchange rates moving against you and losing money just because the Turkish lira devalues. And it's the same for the population of Turkey. People feel more comfortable having their savings in US dollars because they know what the value is. They know that their net worth is not going to be eradicated just because the currency moved against them. So that's why we're seeing high levels of dollarization in Turkey right now. And Moody's are forecasting that there will be a slight increase through the course of 2022. So we're not going to see this problem go away anytime soon. And actually, if we see inflation staying at the sort of levels they're at right now, and I just reported recently that we're almost at 50% inflation for the year to January, then that's going to cause an even higher level of dollarization because more people will lose confidence in the lira and more will want to move into dollars. So what are the issues with regards to dollarization for a country like Turkey? Well, the problem with dollarization is that the central bank loses control of the economy. So we've talked a lot about quantitative easing and interest rates and inflation on this channel. And what you have in most countries is a central bank will be operating its policy and it will have a target rate of inflation. So if we take the US as an example, the target rate of inflation is 2%. Now, one of the reasons that inflation is currently up at 7% is that through the pandemic, the Fed was pumping money into the economy through quantitative easing. So it was issuing bonds in the market to create liquidity, to encourage lenders to give out more loans, and for people to therefore have more money to spend and keep the economy moving. Now that policy was very successful, but the flip side of pumping money into the economy is that it drives up prices. So inflation is now running at around about 7% in the US, and so the Fed is now having to do something to change the situation. So the Fed recently announced that it is stopping quantitative easing and it's also likely to start increasing interest rates because that puts the brakes on the economy, stops people spending and brings prices back down. So the Fed is in control of the US economy and it's now doing things to try to bring back inflation. If we look at Turkey, if 2/3 of all of the economy is using dollars, then that means that they are not in control of 2/3 of all of that spending. So they are now more closely linked to what the US is doing and the US's foreign policy. So Turkey has famously started reducing its interest rates at a time of very high inflation. So that's contrary to traditional economic belief. Now, that won't actually have that big an impact if 2/3 of the economy is actually using US dollars. They are now linked to what's happening for interest rates in America. So the interest rates are likely to start going up in the very short term in America. And that will have an impact directly on Turkey. When interest rates rise, it usually attracts in more investors into an economy and drives up the exchange rate for that currency. So it's likely as the interest rates go up that the dollar will strengthen. And that's going to be bad news for Turkey because as the dollar strengthens, then more people will be attracted to it and less people will be attracted to lira. And the relative exchange rate between the Turkish lira and the dollar will also come under pressure. So at the moment, we've got a relative rate of around about 13.5 Turkish lira to $1. If the dollar increases in value, then that will move above 13.5%. So the Turkish central bank will have the option of either supporting the lira by using more US dollars to buy lira in the currency markets or to just let the exchange rate go. But if they let the exchange rate go, then more people will lose confidence in the lira and more people move to the dollar and it becomes a really vicious circle. So hopefully you're starting to see the problem that you've got that once most of your population and companies are using another currency, it's really difficult to get them to move back to your home currency. And as I mentioned before, the problem gets accentuated by the fact that a lot of companies want to borrow in US dollars and therefore want to retain US dollars. So it's really difficult to break the cycle. Once your own currency loses value, then it's really difficult to get everybody to move 100% back to the Turkish lira. So let's talk about some specific US dollar related problems that are going on right now in Turkey. So as you'll know, if you follow the channel, Turkey has to buy gas from overseas. It uses natural gas to fuel its power stations and also a lot of the homes in Turkey are fed with natural gas for heating and cooking. Turkey does not have large reserves of natural gas, so it has to buy its supplies in from Russia, Azerbaijan and Iran. And the problem with that is that they need large amounts of US dollars to do so. So in December, we reported that over $3 billion was used buying gas, and Turkey is having a very cold spell at the moment. It's had a lot of snow in January, so the demand for gas is rising. And I reported recently that the pressure on the US dollar reserves for Turkey had resulted in some blackouts and a lot of the industry in Turkey having its electricity switched off for a long period. In addition to the gas purchasing, the Turkish central bank has also been supporting the lira in the currency markets. And in December, it used over $7 billion to keep the value of the lira up. And it's reported that that support scheme has continued through January and that the bank is spending around about $1 billion per week to keep the exchange rate constant. So there's a big ongoing requirement for US dollars from the Turkish authorities. And they can see these high level of US dollar deposits in all of the banking system. So they've asked the locals to exchange their US dollar deposits for Turkish lira and that they will guarantee the value of those deposits in the event that the lira does reduce in value compared to the dollar. In addition to that, they've also asked all corporates in Turkey to hand over 25% of all of their foreign currency reserves to the Turkish central bank. Now, the problem with these schemes is that the reason that people have got their money in US dollars is that they don't have any confidence in the Turkish lira. And the value of the deposit protection scheme that's being offered by the Turkish authorities really depends upon the level of success of the economy. So if the Turkish economy does start to struggle, then the value of those deposits is worthless. So it's a big ask for all of the population to be handing over their US dollar deposits, especially when they know that those foreign currency reserves will be used to buy gas or to support the lira in the international markets. So that money is gone forever. It's not an investment. It's not something that the Turkish authorities will get back. They're literally using it just to support what's going on in the country right now. So what's the summary and conclusion today? Well, dollarization is a big problem for a lot of economies around the world. And the biggest issue is that once you've moved to an element of dollarization, it is virtually impossible to get rid of it because people become comfortable with US dollars. They know the value of a US dollar and they see it as a store of value. We talked on this channel before about inflation eroding the value of your money. And people at times of high inflation look for stores of value. So the classic store of value is gold. Everybody sees gold as having long-term inherent value. There's a limited amount of gold in the world. It's a precious metal. Everybody knows the value of it. And therefore, at times of volatility, a lot of investors move into gold because they know that their investment is safe. And that's the same philosophy that everybody is following in these countries for dollarization. They see the US dollar as being a safe haven, a good store of value, and therefore they're happy to put their net worth into dollars at a time when their local currency is devaluing. And that's what's been happening in Turkey over the last few years. So even at the end of 2020, which was before we saw the major devaluation of lira in 2021, even at that point, the level of dollarization was at 45%. So almost half of all of the money in the Turkish economy at that point was US dollars. It's now almost two-thirds of the economy. So there's been a massive increase over the last year or so. And that really reflects the lack of confidence in the Turkish lira. People saw the value falling and wanted to get out of it before it was too late, before the value of their savings was wiped out. So now that everybody's moved into dollars, it's very unlikely that they're going to move back into Turkish lira anytime soon. There's still a lot of volatility in the international markets, and people are worried that the value of the lira is being artificially held up by the Turkish central bank. And the messages that the Turkish central bank are sending, whereby they're asking everybody to hand over their US dollars, isn't giving anybody any confidence that the problem has been solved. It looks more like the Turkish central bank is doing things behind the scenes to keep the value of the lira high in the international currency markets, but actually it's artificially created. If that support scheme stopped, then it is likely that the value of the lira would continue going down, and therefore the value of everybody's savings in lira would also go down. So that confidence factor is very, very difficult to repair. And the problem that Turkey has is that it's now not in control of its own economy, because two-thirds of its economy is linked to the US dollar. So it's now being controlled by what happens in the US rather than its own central policies. So that's another thing that's really difficult to break away from. Once you're locked into that cycle, very, very difficult to go back to the way you used to be. So some major issues for Turkey here, major issues for the currency, but also major issues for the economy. And this is not something that they're going to be able to solve in the next 3 to 6 months or even the next 12 months. So we're going to see continued pressure on Turkey. We're going to see linkages to the US dollar. And as the value of the US dollar starts to go up, as the interest rates go up, then that's going to put even more pressure onto Turkey. So I wanted to post this video so that everybody was aware of what's going on. We focused a lot on Turkish lira and the exchange rate and talked around that a lot. But actually what's going on in Turkey right now is more related to what's happening with the dollar. So that could give the economy a level of stability, because we've seen it in other countries around the world when they've walked away from their own currency and moved to the dollar. It's actually provided them with more stability than they had previously. So this could potentially be a positive thing for Turkey, but unfortunately it'll be negative for the Turkish lira, because as time goes on, it's likely that less people will want to deal in lira and more people will want to deal in dollars. So hopefully you've enjoyed this video, you've liked what I've said. If you did, then please give me a thumbs up, and don't forget to subscribe if you haven't done so already.